Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan again, and the topic of our conversation today is going to be the antebellum commentaries on the Constitution. Now, I think this is perhaps one of the most neglected but important topics of American constitutional thought, and that's because these antebellum commentaries provide much of our intellectual firepower for our side of the argument. Now, there is one major exception to that, and that would be Joseph Story's antebellum commentary. We'll talk about that in this particular presentation. But that commentary was thoroughly dissected and thrashed by Abel Upshur, who was also in this particular presentation. So I think when we start talking about what the Constitution means and what it means for our society today, we should look at these intellectual exercises. Now, Dr. Gutzman's Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution and my Founding Father's Guide to the Constitution are basically this. I mean, both of those books are commentaries on the Constitution. And it used to be that Americans spent a lot of time doing this. We just don't anymore. But I think this is beneficial to society. It's beneficial to government. It's beneficial to our knowledge of the Constitution itself, to our understanding of the Constitution. It's good intellectual gymnastics, so we should be looking at these things more thoroughly and, of course, spending more time with them. And as Americans in our society now, you know, if the earth is to the living, then we should be looking at these things and, you know, still studying the Constitution and still producing our own commentaries for that very reason alone. Now, in the antebellum period, there were dozens of leading political, scholarly, and legal figures who were penning commentaries on the Constitution following its ratification in 1788. So some of the best minds in society were talking about the Constitution and what it meant, whether they were judges, lawyers, political figures, people with an astute political mind, teachers, professors. These people were out there writing about the Constitution, talking about it, discussing it, and at large, whether through the written word or through conversation, the Constitution was on everyone's mind. Now, today, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in Congress, with the exception of maybe a handful of individuals, who talks about the Constitution at all. So a lot has changed in over 200 years, and in reality, that's not a long time. I mean, 200 years is really nothing in human history. So to go from that, from where people discuss this Constitution all the time, even into the 1860s, to where we are today, shows that the government has completely run over the Constitution. We don't even think it's important anymore. I think that alone is a telling sign the Constitution has been shredded and the Constitution is dead. Even Dr. Woods and Dr. Gutzman's book, Who Killed the Constitution, illustrates that. So that's definitely another book you should pick up. Of course, as we move forward in the class and we get to the Progressive Era and other things, that book will come more into play. But these things are so important for our understanding of the Constitution. The commentaries produced during the ratification provide the original, of course, and correct meaning of the Constitution. But these subsequent commentaries, the ones we're going to talk about in this presentation, provide insight into the legal mind of antebellum America. So it's a window into American constitutional history and constitutional theory. And there is only one, I think, that really has given us this nationalist view of the Constitution. Of course, it's cited as, the definitive commentary, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. Now, the early essays on the Constitution, there are several. Of course, John Adams produced one called Defense of the Constitutions of the United States. And if you look at the title of that, essentially what he's talking about there are the early state constitutions. And so he was looking at different forms of American constitutionalism. Of course, Massachusetts has the oldest written constitution in the world. And Adams was not in Philadelphia in 1787. But he was riding back and forth with several of the delegates and talking about what he thought the Constitution should do and what type of language it should have and things of that nature. He also looks at various constitutions throughout history in this particular document. This is why John Adams is often considered by some conservatives to be one of the intellectual progenitors of modern American conservatism. I would tend to disagree with that in some ways, but Adams did have a pretty astute political mind, and he did look at history for examples, as did all of the founders. If you ever want to just read about this particular topic, I think there's a wonderful book. It's by Carl Richard, The Founders and the Classics, and it goes through what the different members of the founding generation thought about several of the classical historians, the Greek and Roman period, and what kind of impact that had on America. Really, you should be looking at that more than perhaps the Enlightenment period. I think that that's overrated in terms of what the founders thought. And the classical period is what these men were focusing on more than anything else. Then, of course, we have the Federalist essays, which everybody talks about. There's 87 essays in defense of the Constitution, or 85 essays, excuse me, defense of the Constitution. Again, cited as the letter as to what you should read if you're going to understand the Constitution. Again, I tend to disagree with that as well, but it is a pretty good collection of essays as to what three individuals thought about the Constitution, and of course one major nationalist and one other nationalist in terms of James Madison, who had kind of had to change his position. Brutus, Cato, and an old Whig, of course, provide nice counterweight to the Federalist essays. These essays are contained in what's called the Anti-Federalist Papers, but they were never contained in such a comprehensive way or collection of essays until later. Brutus from New York, and Cato, New York, and old Whig from Pennsylvania. These are just wonderful, wonderful essays on what the Constitution was going to do. Because if you read these particular essays, they lay out very clearly what the abuse of the Constitution that we're going to get in the future. Then, of course, you have the ratifying conventions themselves and the debates during the conventions. And so all of these, whether it's Pennsylvania or New York or Massachusetts or Virginia, all your major states had an opposition. And so those opposition speeches are pretty good. And also, of course, you should read what people were saying about the Constitution itself from the proponent side. And we talked about this here in the presentation on ratification. People like James Wilson and George Nicholas and others. People like Hamilton, even in New York, and what people were saying, Madison, and what these people were saying about the Constitution, Ellsworth and William Richardson Davy, and all up and down the United States at the time, and what they said about the Constitution itself. Because I think if you understand that, then that would be the Constitution that was ratified, not the one that we have today, this bastardization of the Constitution. Hamilton's defense of the Bank of the United States in 1791 is also excellent. If you read that, of course, it's not good in terms of an interpretation of the Constitution, but it is an interpretation of the Constitution. And, of course, Jefferson's initial response to the bank is also very good to read. And then, of course, the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 and 1799. Again, an excellent treatise on American constitutionalism. So you have all of this stuff leading up to the 1800s. And in the 1800s is when you're going to get this tremendous rush of antebellum commentaries. So first and foremost, let's talk about St. George Tucker. St. George Tucker was a member of the founding generation. He's from Virginia, a law professor, a judge, a legal scholar, perhaps the most important legal scholar from that state. And that's because several descendants later become leading political or legal figures. Plus, he had wide influence because of his time as a law professor. He actually wrote the first commentary on the Constitution following its ratification and the subsequent edition of the Bill of Rights. So if you want to look at first, here it is. St. George Tucker comes out with the first comprehensive look at the Constitution. He also, of course, studied Blackstone read that and dissected that and analyzed that. St. George Tucker is very important. Now, this particular work has actually been published recently and by the Liberty Fund. And it's entitled View of the Constitution of the United States. Clyde Wilson, who was my advisor in graduate school, edited this volume. Now, let me tell you a little story about that. Of course, one day I go into Clyde Wilson's office, and he's very proud of this, and he handed me a copy. He said, here we got this new book on the Constitution. It's wonderful. Everybody should read St. George Tucker. And, of course, I've linked it. It's available for free online now. Everybody should read this. But I fear nobody will. So he was pretty pessimistic about anyone reading St. George Tucker. He said, it would be great if everybody did, but I fear that only us, just basically his students and maybe a handful of people that read Liberty Fund publications, are going to read this thing. Of course, this was 1999, and a lot's changed since 1999. The last 13 years, I think one of the major things that's changed is the influence, the liberty movement itself, and so many more people because of, Mises Institute and Lou Rockwell and the internet, and of course people like you who've subscribed to Liberty Classroom. I have to say that the questions I get on the Constitution here are some of the best questions I've ever had about the Constitution. People are well-read, and they really ask some very good penetrating questions, and I think that's excellent. So we're having a conversation now, and I think that by linking this here, perhaps thousands of people will now, and maybe tens of thousands of people will read this particular publication, because you're going to read it, I would hope at least parts of it, and then maybe you're going to tell one of your friends about reading it. And I've linked all of the things I'm going to talk about in this presentation online, so you can go out there and read them. They're all free. I mean, that's wonderful. So there's not even enough to put out a dime for this, so it's just go out there and read the stuff. But, Clyde was very open about his pessimism that this book would even have an impact. And now I hope by putting this in this presentation, it does, at least to some extent. Here's a quotation from the particular book, and this is talking about the nature of the union. And again, this has been a recurring theme over time in this course. Even when I have the presentation on the Progressive Era, and we talk about the 17th Amendment, that fundamentally altered the nature of the union. And so that union, the idea of what is a union, is going to be changed so drastically after 1865 that it's not even recognizable. And so when St. George Tucker was talking about the union in 1803, this is what he said. He said, "The Constitution of the United States of America, then, is an original, written, federal, and social compact, freely, voluntarily, and solemnly entered into by the several states of North America, and ratified by the people thereof, respectively, whereby the several states and the people thereof, respectively, have bound themselves to each other, and to the federal government of the United States, and by which the federal government is bound to the several states, and to every citizen of the United States." So this is a compact between sovereign states and the sovereign people of the sovereign states. Not between the people and the central government without the states being involved in this. So Tucker's treatise is just littered with this stuff. I mean, it's, as you read it, you find that what St. George Tucker said was that here you have a constitution as a compact among sovereign states that has clearly defined powers. And those powers cannot be abridged or abused. They cannot be enlarged. None of that stuff is true. Everything that we've been hearing about, these elastic powers, it's hogwash. It's made up. We've all been bamboozled by this. So this is why St. George Tucker was picking up his pen and writing. When I said at the beginning of this presentation that these commentaries give us the intellectual fuel, they give us the muscle, this is what I mean. Because if you read these things, it's very clear that a very intelligent and articulate and well-read group of people in antebellum America thought just like us. My gosh, what's happened to it? So if more Americans read these things, I think we'd have a much different interpretation of the Constitution today, which is why I wanted to have a presentation on the antebellum commentaries. Next, of course, we have John Taylor of Caroline, also from Virginia, the leading Jeffersonian theorist of his time, even better than Jefferson. People would say he's more Jeffersonian than Jefferson himself. In fact, Jefferson praised him for his articulation of American principles, and that's the important thing, of American principles, not European, not something else that they just fabricated. These are American principles. In fact, John Tyler, President John Tyler, said basically when he was vetoing all this Whig legislation, all this nationalist legislation, he's following the principles of 76. Those were the American principles. So I think it's important that we hang on to that, because if we don't, we're just running away from our traditions, from that American tradition, which is so important to both, conservatives and libertarians alike. He was an opponent of centralization, artificial aristocracy, and the fusion of government and organized finance. He was also a major antagonist of John Adams, John Marshall, and Alexander Hamilton. So that makes him good right there. I mean, if this guy doesn't like John Adams, John Marshall, and Alexander Hamilton, he's a good guy. He also supported secession. Now, there's the old story, Oliver Ellsworth and Rufus King cornered him in a setup and said, "Look, we want to secede from the Union." Taylor was kind of taken back by that, but later on he would say, he completely agrees, and this was no problem. Now, there I've linked to his best book on the Constitution, New Views of the Constitution of the United States. One thing you can say about Taylor, it's very his writings are pretty dense and hard to get through, but they're worth it if you can take the time to do it. He's got a number of great books. This one is one of his last, but I think that if you take the time to read John Taylor of Caroline, you would come out with a much better understanding of American constitutionalism. And this book in particular was a systematic dissection of the Federalist and notes of the Philadelphia Convention. So what he's doing is going out there and looking at the Federalist and saying, okay, here we've got, you know, we've got the Federalist essays. Well, were they lying or not? When he brings out the Philadelphia Convention, he looks at that and says, okay, what do they mean by this, this, and this, and these particular parts of the Constitution? But he also basically comes out with this idea, and it's something that I think is important, that an American people do not exist. People of separate states, yes, but no American nation. So he's an anti-nationalist. And we have to be very careful. When people throw this word around, I don't think people even know what they're talking about when they say, well, our nation is being affected by this, the American nation. Well, John Taylor of Caroline would say, what American nation? That doesn't even exist. There's no American nation. It's a union of sovereign independent states. And the people of Virginia are as, you know, different from the people of Massachusetts as night and day. They're different. Yeah, sure, they might share a common language. There might be some similarities in other things, but they're different. And I think he recognized that, as did Northerners in this particular period of time. It's only been since 1865 that we have this crazy notion that we have a single unified people. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln created that fallacy. He only was picking that up from people like Daniel Webster and John Marshall and Alexander Hamilton. I mean, this is the real problem. That's the lineage that we have to be crushing at all times. The Hamilton to Marshall, and then Marshall to Story, and of course, Marshall to Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, and then those guys on to Abraham Lincoln, and then Abraham Lincoln on to every single nationalist in the United States today. If we could start breaking down this nationalism and start looking at the American people as they are, maybe separate nations, nations within nations, sovereign independent states who had delegated certain authority to the Union and to the central government, I think we'd be a lot better off. I mean, we've seen some great strides in that with, you know, the 10th Amendment movement, but we need more, and this is why this stuff is so important. Now, the best chapter in this particular book is the chapter titled Sovereignty, and I've actually quoted some of that here. And this is a quote from Taylor. He said, "The first confederation or union recognizes the compatibility between the Union and the sovereignty of the states. The existing Union adheres to the same idea, professes to establish a more perfect Union of states created by the Declaration of Independence." And I mentioned this in earlier presentations about ratification and the Philadelphia Convention. "And contains many provisions incapable of being executed except by state sovereignty. It uses the words United States, taken from the first confederation, from the Declaration of Independence, and transplanted from both these instruments, in which they are associated with positive assertions of the independence and sovereignty of each state. And therefore, the last instrument, the Constitution is what he's talking about, like the others, recognizes the compatibility between the Union and the sovereignty of the several states." So essentially, if you put this in 21st century American, all John Taylor is saying here is, okay, look, you have the Declaration, then you have the Articles of Confederation. Both recognize the sovereignty of the states. And the Articles of Confederation had a union of sovereign states. And by the Constitution wanting to form a more perfect union, that term union didn't change. It still recognized the sovereignty of the states. So nothing has changed from the Declaration to the Constitution. And he's 100% right. And I mentioned that with the Articles. You know, did the Constitution force a secession from the Articles? Well, I think you could take that stand. You could also say that the Constitution was a simple continuation of the Articles in some way. In that it was trying to keep that same union with certain modifications that were made in the Constitution. That's it. So if that's the case, I mean, if we look at it as not necessarily scrapping the Articles, but simply changing the nature of the union to an extent, not necessarily the nature of the union, but the certain powers of the union, I think then the union stays the same. That's all John Taylor's trying to convey here. He also said this: "The construction bestows the same meaning upon the same words and our three constituent or elemental instruments, and exhibits the reason why the whole language of the Constitution is a finance to the idea of a league between sovereign states and hostile to that of a consolidated nation. There are many states in America, but no state of America." This is very important. "Nor any people of an American state. A constitution for America or Americans would therefore have been similar to a constitution for utopia or utopians." I think that's a wonderful line. "A constitution for America or Americans would therefore have been similar to a constitution for utopia or utopians. And of course, if you look at the original translation of the word utopia, this the first time it was used was in 1516 by Sir Thomas More. Utopia in Latin, utopos, means nowhere. So by saying it's similar to a constitution for utopia or utopians, it's similar to a constitution for nowhere and nobody. It does not exist. He's going with a literal translation there, not a perfect society or a perfect world, but the literal translation of utopia. Very important to understand that designation. So he's saying, look, these three constitutions operate the same. It's the same thing. You can say the Constitution changed everything. Well, it really didn't. The Union stayed the same, and the nature of the Union stayed the same as a compact between sovereign states. They had delegated more power to the central government. They had created an executive branch and a judicial branch, but that Union fundamentally stayed the same. And if you look at it that way, I think Taylor is 100% accurate. If we look at it in that regard, it blows up the entire nationalist argument. Because even under the Articles of Confederation, we didn't have a nation. And so what Taylor is saying is under the Constitution, we still don't have a nation. It doesn't exist. There's no American people. There's no any people of an American state, a state of America, or a United State, not the United States. So he's saying the United States, that plural, is important. Taylor is wonderful. If you ever have a chance to read Taylor, I would highly recommend it. Go out and look at that link that I have. Do a search on Google Books. You can find all of his writings for free. If you want to get my impression of Taylor, of course, I wrote about him in my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. Clyde Wilson wrote the chapter on John Taylor and Our Forgotten Conservatives in American History, so that's always wonderful to read what Clyde said about him. And of course, Dr. Gussman's written a lot about him, too, in his books on Virginia. So pick up anything you can on John Taylor. Just a fantastic reading. Now, next is a guy named William Rawl. Now, William Rawl is kind of a forgotten figure, like St. George Tucker. You know, people talk about John Taylor of Caroline, but Rawl and St. George Tucker, not much. Rawl was from Pennsylvania, so this is interesting. So we've had two Virginians, right? So people say, well, that's just Virginia. You know, Virginia is just these crazy guys in the antebellum period. Well, here's a guy from Pennsylvania. He was also a Federalist, Federalist lawyer, a judge, legal scholar, good friends with George Washington, Benjamin Franklin. So, I mean, he had been around a while. He used his book, which is A View of the Constitution of the United States of America, which was published in 1825 and 1829, was used as a textbook at West Point and other institutions. So this actually became kind of like a college textbook on the Constitution. And the important thing about this college textbook is this section on secession. William Rawl explicitly states that secession was a right of the states, and he also alludes to nullification. Because essentially what he's saying is there's a limited supremacy of the federal government. Now, this is a Pennsylvania Federalist saying these things. So, of course, the Federalists in 1787 and 1788 were basically saying these things. Now, William Rawl has, you know, fast-forwarded 30 years. He's saying the same things. The idea never went away. It's just that some people decided that, well, that doesn't work for us anymore, so we're not going to follow that. So there's wonderful stuff. The book is a little bit more dense, but it's not bad. And, of course, if you want to see what an antebellum textbook on the Constitution looked like, I'd highly recommend clicking on this link and just going to look at it. These are some quotes from William Rawl. It will be seen that, in some cases, a state has the right to claim the aid of the judicial power of the Union, and in all, it is bound to support the legislative and executive acts of the general government when consistent with the Constitution. There is the caveat. It will be seen that, in some cases, a state has the right to claim the aid of the judicial power of the Union, and in all, it is bound to support the legislative and executive acts of the general government when consistent with the Constitution. Exactly what the Supremacy Clause says. If it's not consistent with the Constitution, then obviously you don't have to follow that. The supremacy of the Union in all those points that are thus transferred, and the sovereignty of the state in all those which are not transferred, must therefore be considered as two coordinate qualities. So here he's bringing up the sovereign states. If the laws are made not consistent with the Constitution, then you don't have to follow them. And so you have two sovereign spheres of influence. You have the federal government and the powers that are delegated to it by the states, and you have the states and everything else. The Constitution and the federal government, the central government, cannot infringe upon those rights. So this is wonderful stuff. And he actually said this, the states then may wholly withdraw from the Union. I mean, my gosh. There it is. know, so people have asked me before, well, where does it say in the Constitution the states can withdraw? It doesn't have to. The states, by nature of a compact, states can leave that compact. And William Rawl is pointing that out. And now, this guy is not some radical states' rights Democratic Republican from Virginia or from the South. He's from Pennsylvania, and he's a Federalist. There's no clearer example that needs to be shown than this. That Federalists, even. I mean, you can find evidence of Federalists who wanted secession all day long when, you know, during Jefferson's election, even before that, with the Louisiana Purchase and, of course, the Hartford Convention. You can find this stuff all day long. But everyone seems to forget this stuff. I mean, it's only these radical Southerners who talked about seceding from the Union. No, not at all. In fact, Northerners started talking about it first. And here's a Northerner saying you can do it. Now, here's the big one that we have to wrestle with, Joseph Story. Joseph Story, of course, was from Massachusetts, lawyer, Supreme Court justice, legal theorist, and, of course, most importantly, John Marshall's protege. So there is the key. Joseph Story is John Marshall light. John Marshall took him under his wing and made Story his project. And, of course, Story, by writing his commentaries on the Constitution of the United States in 1833, along with the Federalist Essays, this is what everyone reads to say, well, this is what the Constitution means. I'm going to read the Federalist Essays, and I'm going to read Joseph Story. And my gosh, I just want to stab myself in the eyeballs. Because the fact is, these two pieces of literature, in the Federalist Essays, Hamilton's lying, straight out lying in 55 of them. And here you have Joseph Story, essentially building off of Hamilton and Marshall arguments. That's all he's doing. He's taking their arguments and saying, well, here's the Constitution. This is the worst thing that ever happened. And so I say here, he's a nationalist who adopted Hamilton and Marshall's broad interpretation of federal, what they called national powers. And he wrote what has been incorrectly called, in modern America, the standard interpretation of the Constitution. When people talk about constitutional, commentaries, Joseph Story will come up number one. So we got to deal with this guy, but he is completely off in every single way imaginable. There's no nation, as I've already pointed out. This nationalist argument was a weak interpretation of the Constitution. At least the Constitution is ratified. It's horrible. And, of course, it needs to be trashed. And people did it. You can go back to the stuff written before it, or you can go with Abel Upshur, who I'll talk about next, to look at how this thing was just thoroughly filleted and knifed apart. But let's look at what Joseph Story said. Now, because of space and time, I've linked to it again. It's free. You can go out there and read it. And if you want to have a good laugh or if you want to inflict pain upon yourself, I mean, sometimes, it might be better to just, like I said, stab yourself in the eyes and actually read this thing because it's pretty horrible. But, take the time to look at it. It'd be a good exercise, in intellectual gymnastics. So this is some of his claims. The Union is not a compact, but a national republic that the people created en masse. En masse. So, basically, this is the one people argument. So, the people of the United States created the Constitution. Now, that's funny. Because the people weren't there in Philadelphia. The people of the states ratified the Constitution, but they had to do it in state conventions. There wasn't one national convention that was called to ratify the Constitution. I mean, had that happened, okay, I could understand this argument. If when the Constitution was going through the ratification process, all the states then sent another convention that had thousands of members that ratified the document in one large convention. But that's not what happened. States could reject it by the people of the states in convention. So this idea that there's a national republic, I mean, like France, this is crazy. We don't have a national republic, we have a federal republic. So Joseph Story is already making stuff up as he goes, and he's basically just buying John Marshall and Alexander Hamilton. The Constitution superseded, not modified, the Confederation. So this is the argument that, of course, John Taylor was making, that no, the Constitution simply modified the Articles of Confederation, in that it kept the Union. The Union stayed the same, but it just added some more power and changed the nature of government, the central government. But the Union stayed the same. But Story is saying, no, it superseded that. It just said the Articles are gone, and what we have now is this thing, which is a national government. Well, I think when you start saying that the state seceded from the Articles, that's the argument. You're actually buying into Joseph's story here, and I think that it's an incorrect argument. Federal law is supreme, regardless of constitutionality. And Joseph Story would say that. Federal law is supreme, regardless of whether it's constitutional or not. Once the federal government makes a law, it's supreme. The states have to abide by it. And of course, the federal government then becomes the final decision maker in this entire process. They have unlimited power over their own interpretation, because the Congress can pass a law, the President signs it into law, and the Supreme Court then would decide whether it's constitutional. Well, if you do that, where's the check, right? And of course, he's also going to believe in judicial review. As I just said, the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of all constitutional issues arising both under state and federal law. So here again, he's going back on what was sworn up and down at the ratifying conventions, the states will never be abused. The states will always have their input, and the states, state law will always be supreme in its sphere of influence. So basically, again, Story's channeling Marshall, who's channeled Hamilton. And then, of course, Lincoln, Clay, and Webster channeled Story, and thus the unbroken nationalist strand in American history. So these are the individuals. I mean, if you want to talk about, it'd be great to have a book called The Scoundrels of America and put all these wonderful individuals in there. You know, you got Marshall and Story and Hamilton and Lincoln and Clay and Webster and Wilson and the Roosevelts. I mean, just, you know, the scoundrels of America. From a libertarian position, I think, or a paleoconservative position, these are it. Put them all in there and explain how they're all bad. Now, Story wasn't without his critics, and of course, one arose very quickly, another Virginian, Abel P. Upshur. He was also a lawyer, judge, secretary of Navy, and secretary of state, and a legal scholar. He was a Whig in the truest sense of the term, an opponent to centralization and executive power. His good friend John Tyler, of course, became president, and these guys were old states' rights Whigs. So they were elected in 1840. Tyler was elected in 1840 as vice president because the idea was to get the states' rights individual, the guy that had voted against the force bill in the Senate, the only guy who did, the only person who made a speech against it in the Senate. I mean, this is how amazing this guy was. Of course, they think they need to get him on there on board. And if you don't know what the force bill is, you know, look up the nullification issue in South Carolina. So Tyler's out there making a speech against it. It's wonderful. You know, people said you're going to ruin your career, and here he becomes president. So he's put on the ticket to get these states' rights votes. And when Harrison dies, their hope of, you know, all this Whig nationalist legislation dies with him, because Tyler becomes president and starts vetoing all this stuff. And he puts Abel Upshur, of course, at one point as Secretary of State, which was a great move. Now, Upshur is going to be killed in an accident on a boat. And then, of course, John C. Calhoun will become Secretary of State. But in 1840, Upshur writes perhaps the best refutation of Story's commentaries, and was perhaps the last great commentary of the antebellum period. It's called A Brief Inquiry into the True Nature and Character of Our Federal Government. Now, the chapter in The Forgotten Conservatives in American History that I've wrote with Clyde Wilson, I actually wrote this chapter on Tyler and Upshur, so it was a lot of fun to write, and of course, again, I've linked the book. So, for free, you can go out there and get this commentary for free. And these are some of the great things that Upshur has to say. The American people have never been one people. So now he's attacking this idea that we have one people, just like John Taylor of Caroline did. He said that Story and other nationalists engaged in an imaginative construction of the Constitution, as did Webster, Clay, and Lincoln later. So this is an imaginative construction. They're making this stuff up because it suits their needs. And that's exactly what they were doing. They're making this stuff up as they go. You know, Hamilton had made up his arguments on 1791, and of course John Marshall's making up his arguments, then Joseph Story's making up his arguments, and then you got people like Clay and Webster making up their arguments, and then later Lincoln making up his arguments, and on down the line. You can get into the progressive movement, they're making up arguments. So Taylor says this is imaginative construction. You have to imagine. Well, let's see, we the people really means this. No, it meant what it meant in 1787 and 1788. He said, consolidation was never the aim of the Constitution, and the Union retained its nature as under the Articles of Confederation. Sound familiar? He's basically channeling John Taylor of Caroline. Secession and nullification were remedies to save the Union, not destroy it. So if you threaten secession and nullification, and of course, particularly with nullification, if you use nullification, it would actually save the Union, keep it in line. Secession, even if the state seceded, the Union still stayed. And this is essentially what Calhoun argued as well in the 1830s. So, in summary, the commentaries were fantastic intellectual exercises in the 19th century. Only one major commentary focused on a nationalist interpretation. That was Story. And we didn't need any more because we also have Marshall court opinions. So, I mean, there's the other nationalist, commentary on it. Marshall was, ruminating from the bench, waxing intellectual about the Constitution incorrectly. So, it's just, we already have that. We have Hamilton, so we don't need it. But all these other commentaries served as counterweights, and I think we should get more of this stuff. It helps us understand the Constitution. So clearly, many legal scholars view the Constitution as a compact among states, not among one people. And of course, these commentaries have been whitewashed. I can guarantee you that if you take a constitutional history course, whether it's in graduate school, as an undergraduate, or as a law student, you're not going to get this stuff. So this is why Liberty Classroom is great. You get it here, and that's wonderful. This is great fuel for the debate on the true nature of the federal government, as I said before. So read these things, digest them, and when your idiot friends start trying to say, well, I have a friend who's a Harvard lawyer, and he says, a Harvard attorney, and he says that the Constitution is a compact, then you say, oh, wait a second here. First of all, we got the ratifying debates, which says it was. We've got James Madison, who says it was. Then we've got all these commentaries that says it is. How do you challenge that? Well, what about Joseph Story? Okay, well, what about Abel Upchur, who took him to task? What about the Federalist Essays? Okay, what about John Taylor, who took them to task? Just go back and look at this stuff and say, well, here you go. You smarty pants. And what do you think about that now? And I think you're going to corner them, and they won't know what to say, because most of the time they're not going to have a response. So you become the smarty pants, and let people know that you know what you're talking about with the Constitution. Because if you have this intellectual muscle behind you, there's nobody that can beat you in a debate. All right. Well, I'll see you next time for the next presentation.